I'm Bert Cohen. It's time for Portside. And one of the things about the USA is that we seem to always be at war. There was the, of course, the First World War, Second World War, War on Poverty, which didn't seem to work. But we kind of, it seems, like to categorize things in terms of war. If there's something we don't like, the government makes war on it. Welcome to another edition of Portside. I'm Bert Cohen. And today I'm very pleased to have with us Peter Criss. Thanks for being here.
Bert, thanks for sharing your audience with me.
Well, thank you. And this is about the war on drugs. The war on drugs in the front line of the war are, of course, the soldiers. And the soldiers in the war on drugs have been largely police officers, state, local, and federal police, all participating in this war on drugs. And Peter Criss retired as a police captain, so he knows whereof he speaks, after a 20-year career enforcing drug laws. 20 years. From the beginning, Peter believed the drug war can never be won, and it's doing more harm than good. He retired in 1989, and Peter began speaking out publicly against that war on drugs. And he originated the idea of creating LEAP, Law Officers Against Prohibition, a drug policy reform group of current and former members of law enforcement modeled after the very successful Vietnam Veterans Against the War. After all, who knew more about the war than the warriors themselves? So in 2002, after 4 years of Peter's preparation, LEAP emerged. Great name, LEAP, I must say. In addition to working for drug policy reform, Peter is a member of the Police Conference of New York, the Western New York Association of Retired Police Officers, and the Police Captains and Lieutenants Association of Erie County. So Law Enforcement Against Prohibition was formed by cops, judges, and others in the criminal system who believe the war on drugs has been a hugely expensive failure that has made our nation's tragic drug problem even worse. After devoting their careers to being frontline warriors in the war on drugs, members have come to believe that the only way to reduce drug abuse and the many harms associated with their current approach to the problem is by legalizing and regulating illicit drugs. Well, again, thanks for being with us. What has the war accomplished? People are afraid of drugs. People, adults are largely parents, and we're worried about what drugs can do to our kids. Drugs have caused significant problems, not the least of which is death, quite frankly. People overdose on drugs and certainly misbehave. And what have the effects of the drug war been? Has it accomplished what it set out to do?
Well, no. If we make a war on something, the way we know that we accomplish something is we defeat the enemy. And the enemy is then gone. We don't have to worry about it anymore. Okay, we're not still in a war with Germany and Japan and, you know,
right,
and Spain and as far back as you want to go. But the I ask at every presentation I give, and I'm talking about Rotary clubs, Kiwanis clubs, you know, those crazy lefty radical things like that.
Yeah.
And I ask them always to raise your hand if you think we can make drugs go away.
Mm.
You know, we won the war, we defeated the enemy, it's gone, we don't have to worry about it anymore.
Right.
And nobody ever raises their hand.
Hmm.
So that is not one of our choices. What we have created in this society is what I call the drug monolith.
Hmm.
We hear about an overdose of those problems you were talking about with people acting up because they're high on drugs and stuff.
Right.
And we say that's the drug problem. Then we hear about a drive-by shooting someplace or the violence on the Mexican border that we're currently dealing with. And we say that's the drug problem. In reality, these are two separate problems. The first one, the overdoses, those problems, those are the drug problem. They are connected with the use of these very dangerous substances and so on and so forth. The other problem, the shootings, the violence, that is not the drug problem. That is, in fact, the drug policy problem. Just like the St. Valentine's Day massacre back in 1929, where seven people were mowed down in a garage in Chicago, nobody referred to that as an alcohol-related problem. They all knew that that wasn't because somebody got drunk and went out and killed people. They knew that that problem was fueled by the fact that we had chosen in this society a policy of prohibition to deal with our alcohol problem rather than a policy of regulation and control. And 4 short years after that event, we ended alcohol prohibition. Now,
wow.
We didn't end it because we changed our mind about alcohol.
Right.
We knew in 1933 the same thing we knew in 1920 about alcohol, and that is that it's a very dangerous substance, and it's at the root of a lot of problems that we have in society. But what we learned in 13 years is the alcohol problem, a problem that is going to be with us forever. That problem is one problem, but we didn't need the gang violence problem that was associated with it. According to the federal government, 75% of the violence associated with drugs in our society today, 75% of that violence is associated with people fighting over the marketplace, or the term the government used, marketplace disputes. Now, we don't need that illegal marketplace. It doesn't help us. It doesn't give us any way to better deal with our drug problem because it, in fact, forces people away from the help that they need by also labeling them as criminals.
Mm.
So what we need is a regulated and controlled marketplace. We need to deal with our drug problem as a healthcare and an educational problem, which it truly is. And we have to look at our successes. We have gotten 50% of the adult cigarette smokers in this society to give up tobacco, the most addictive drug we know of, over the last 10 years, and we did it without banning one cigarette, but simply by educating the public and using a little something we learned from the Amish, which is shunning. You know, you can't smoke anywhere now. You have to go outside or in a special room or something like that.
Yes.
We've made it a little bit less convenient, and people are slowing down their use of this very dangerous substance.
Wow. Interesting.
That's something we know that works.
Yeah.
On the other hand, we have this drug war. Now, it's interesting with the current president wanting to get rid of the term drug war. I use that when I talk in my presentation. The fact that they call this a war on drugs, because there's a lot of things that come with that. If you say to somebody, we have to end the drug war, people respond to you with war metaphor. They say things like, that's surrender, that's giving up.
Right.
And when you talk about changing a bad policy, nobody ever calls changing a bad policy surrender or giving up. We call that correction, so, you know, making it better, solving a problem. So the war on drugs has other benefits to it besides just the term that it energizes everybody, but it also gives any failure of that is a surrender or a giving up. And I don't want to surrender. I didn't spend 20 years dragging a badge and gun around thinking that surrender is a good idea.
Yeah.
I want to see us do things that we know work, and what we know work is education and treatment, and what we know doesn't work is to create this gang violence problem we have in our society.
Wow, you've certainly looked into this issue quite a bit here. Fascinating. And I think about you know, when prohibition against alcohol came in, it seemed to me it wasn't simply puritanical. It was that a lot of women, wives and mothers in particular, saw that their husbands beat them and got terribly violent when they were on the drug alcohol. So the goal was to stop the violence there by banning alcohol. Well, as we all know, it didn't work. And it's fascinating that you point out that, that prohibition against alcohol was only 4 years. We think about that now. When people think about prohibition in the 1920s, what you think about is, as you say, the massacres, the Valentine's Day massacre. That was about people, the market. You think about the tremendous violence, machine guns on the street. You right. don't think about people stopping alcohol. They just snuck it in back rooms. Everybody was doing alcohol.
Exactly. And it's the same way with drugs in our society. According to the UN, this drug problem is a worldwide $500 billion a year industry. Now, you're not going to dissuade people from reaching out and grabbing some of that money. You know, I have people say to me all the time, well, if you legalize drugs, do you think these criminals are just going to become honest, you know, people? And they're, and my answer is no.
Of course
no.
not.
The criminals are going to stay criminals. The problem and the reality of this is the vast number of people that are involved in this trade are in fact not criminals. They are opportunists. They are people that see a chance to make a quick buck and take the risks and say, what the heck, I'm going to do it. Now, they're criminals because we've criminalized this behavior. But they're not out there banging people over the head and stealing people's money. They're in fact selling something to somebody that that buyer wants to buy.
Right.
You know, and you're not going to dissuade that. And in fact, the biggest failure of this policy is I think exemplified by one fact. We do not, in the United States of America, have one drug-free prison. There is a drug problem in every prison in America. Now, if we can't keep drugs out of prisons, who is going to be delusional enough to think that we can keep them out of a free society?
Wow.
It's not possible. My mother, I was one of those people that was fortunate enough to have two wonderful parents.
Great.
And my mother had all kinds of advice for me, so did my father. But one of the things my mother used to say is, if you have a problem in life, there are three things you can do. The first thing you should do is make the problem go away. How do you do that? You solve it. You work it out. Good advice. Two, if you can't do one, if you can't make the problem go away, then you have to seriously consider running away from the problem. And I know that sounds cowardly when people hear it, but the example I like to use, if somebody comes running into the room you're in right now yelling fire, my advice to you is to get out of the building.
Absolutely.
Sometimes running away is the right thing to do.
That's
and then three, if you can't do one or two, if you cannot solve it and you cannot run away from it, you have to learn to live with the problem so it does the least amount of harm in your life as possible.
Least amount of harm.
Exactly. And today we know, as I said before, we can't solve the problem. We can't make the drugs go away. I had a woman come up to me in Connecticut and told me her sad story a few years ago. She said that she was born in New York City, was raised in New York City, got married in New York City, and then had children in New York City. And when her children got to be school-aged, they moved out of New York City up to Connecticut to get away from the drugs. And then she told me the sad story, and that was the drugs had followed them to Connecticut. Well, we all know better than that. The drugs are inanimate objects. They don't follow anybody anywhere. Somebody's got to carry them. But I understand her point. The reality is there is nowhere in America where you can go to get away from drugs. As I said before, not even prison.
Right.
So we can't make them go away. We can't run away from them. How do we live with them so they do the least amount of harm?
Right.
As I stated earlier, 75% of the violence we associate with drugs is associated with the marketplace. We can shut down that marketplace.
And that's one thing that certainly one thing that has marked the drug war, and we should talk about a little bit of the history, is supply side economics versus demand side economics. Mm-hmm. And Ronald Reagan, who did not initiate this war on drugs, I believe it was Richard Nixon, I think, but it's been Democrat and Republican, tried to deal with the supply side when you hear of our tax dollars being used to go down to various countries in South America to attack the marijuana and cocaine cultivation. We use, as I say, our tax dollars, and we attack the supply. People do get, in fact, killed in there. We attack the supply. Well, until it just seems logical, and where there's a demand, there's going to be a supply. We haven't had a war on campaign contributions. We try to control campaign contributions and have all kinds of mechanisms and bureaucracies set up to control and monitor excess campaign contributions. But when there is a huge demand by the TV stations and the radio stations for money to get elected, well, guess what? If you ban one way of coming up with the money, where there's a demand, there's going to be a supply. And the president of Mexico, the presidents of various South American countries have said, you know, it's about making money. It's about these people surviving, and they can grow coca, as they have for thousands of years, and marijuana. But it's the demand. If there's a demand, there's going to be money. So I wonder, you know, the drug war doesn't seem to have worked. What can we do about the demand?
Well, what we have to do is educate. What we have to do is take the glamour out of it that the gangsters bring to it. That's a certain level of glamour that's involved in it. Yeah. Drug abuse is not a pretty thing. Drug use, that's a different set of circumstances, and that's one of the things that we have to change in our thinking in this society. I'll give you an example. The Protestant Reformation, late 1800s, is what really kicked off the Prohibition movement. And as you said, the women's rights movement, that was, they were part of it. They were also part of bringing an end to Prohibition. I'll get into that a little bit later.
Wow.
But that effort, you saw in our newspaper reporting and things like that, by about 1916, 1917, the word drinker had disappeared from our reporting, and it was replaced by the word drunkard, so that every drinker was a drunkard, okay? And we had this, we created as part of bringing us Prohibition, this myth that there was no such thing as a casual alcohol user. Well, we know in a real world today that the vast majority of the people that use alcohol are not drunkards.
Right.
They are simply casual users, and it's that reality that exists with all the other drugs. So the amount of people that have problems with their drug use, no matter what the drug is very small in comparison to the vast number of people that are using these things recreationally, or as, you know, as a like a cocktail on a Friday night after work or something like that.
Right.
So we've created this myth around this, just like they did at the beginning of Prohibition, to create this idea that everybody is an addict. And that is not the case. It's kind of like we have these diversion programs now. So instead of spending our money by putting these people in prison, we can divert people in drug court to, you know, treatment programs and stuff.
Okay.
Well, just because you get arrested for possessing a drug does not mean you need treatment. Just like if alcohol was illegal and you got arrested for having a six-pack of beer, that doesn't mean you're an alcoholic. You know, I mean, you could just be somebody that was having a party on Friday and wanted to pick up a six-pack of beer.
And
so we have to readjust the way we look at this whole thing, and we have to understand that we had a huge heroin problem over with our Vietnam vets over in Vietnam during the war.
Yeah,
90% of those vets that were using heroin over in Vietnam stopped using it on their own without treatment as soon as they got back to the States, because once the pain was gone, they didn't need the pain medication anymore.
Mm.
And that's the reality
of drug
use. Now, we have this idea that everybody that uses heroin is an addict. Well, right. The number of people that are heroin users that are addicts is about 10%. The rest of them are casual users. And I know in our thinking and with what we've been told all throughout the 20th century.
Propaganda.
That's almost impossible. I sound like an idiot even saying that. But those are the facts. Those are the facts.
Facts can be stubborn things, can't they?
Yes. And
we're talking with Peter Crist, a retired police captain who was on the front line for 20 years enforcing drug laws in the war on drugs. And I'm Bert Cohen. We're here on Portside. And, you know, we could talk about the logic of it. Does it make sense? And, you know, it's been a huge drain of resources. It's created, as it did in the prohibition against alcohol, this very wealthy, very powerful drug underground, as we've seen in Mexico here, because it's so profitable, because there's a demand and a supply is hard to get. Well, isn't this one of the laws of economics where there's a big demand and it's hard to get the supply, the price goes up?
Yep.
It's just the way it works. Now, the war on drugs, my recollection is it kind of where the term war on drugs, when did it start? Was it under President Nixon or?
Yeah, that was the Nixon administration. In fact, I have this little delusion in my brain of that meeting where they decided that they were going to do this. And
they decided
they needed a name for it.
Uh-huh.
And I wonder if somebody around the table said, let's call this the new prohibition. And then everybody else said, oh, no. Everybody knows that doesn't work. Let's think of something else.
That's funny.
How about calling it a war on drugs? Hey, there's a great idea. You know, people will get behind that. And we ended up with the war on drugs. And we've been dealing with that term and that policy. You know, it's interesting. I joined the Navy when I was 17 years old. I'm a Vietnam-era veteran, not a Vietnam War veteran, and I always make that very clear to people because I had some friends of mine that didn't come back from that war and some other friends of mine that came back messed up from that war.
Right.
And I don't even want to suggest or let in somebody's mind think that I went through that terrible experience. But I was in the service during that period. And right along that time that I joined is right around that time that we got rid of the draft. And then I got out of there, and I joined the police department, and I got drafted into a war. You know, I didn't want to join this war. This wasn't something that I thought was a good idea, but I got drafted into it, you know. And I had to deal with the problems that this policy had created, the problems in my community that created, the problems of people that needed help. I've seen overdose deaths that could have been prevented if people had called, you know, for help as soon as the person first had their problem. We had that college basketball star, Len Bias, that died of a cocaine problem. And he went into three seizures before his friends finally called for help, because they knew the root of it was cocaine, and that would destroy his career.
Right.
And they wanted to protect him, and what they ended up doing was denying him help, and he died. So, I've seen those problems in my community.
And
I've seen the problems of alcohol in my community. We had young people die of overdoses of alcohol, drinking too much at one time and dying of alcohol poisoning. Now, not one of the officers, even the most avid drug warrior officers that I worked with, none of them, when they saw that problem, suggested bringing back alcohol prohibition as a way to deal with it.
Right.
Because they all knew that was a dumb idea.
But for
the other drugs, it seems like the only answer.
And as you say, with Len Bias and other people like that, calling for help is unlikely, because it's illegal. And then
exactly
the thing.
Maybe he'll get through it okay, you know.
We won't get busted, right?
There's so many I like to say that there's a phrase that you and I have both used in our life, and everybody listening out there has used at some time in their life, and I believe this phrase has been used by every human being that's ever lived on the planet. And that phrase is, it seemed like such a good idea when I thought of it.
So the drug war may be that.
And that sums up the drug war. It seemed like a great idea. We'll just declare a war on drugs. That'll be it. We'll make the punishment so atrocious and send so many people to prison that people will just be dissuaded from using it, and we'll solve our drug problem.
Right.
Well, we got exactly the opposite of that. In fact, it's made the problem worse. Where we used to have heroin was a big city problem, Now it's at every little village in Kansas.
Whoa.
So it's you can, I mean, there's nowhere in America where you are forced to be drug free, because there's drugs available anywhere, and they're sold by an underground market, so there's no guarantee of purity.
True.
You don't know what you're buying, and we're employing children in this marketplace. Just like, I'll give you another example. There used to be a thing called the numbers racket.
Right.
And it made millions of dollars for the mob, and they employed children sometimes. They were numbers runners.
Right.
They went around and collected the nickels, dimes, and quarters from people
right.
that supplied the money for the mob for this activity. And we tried to stamp it out. We tried to arrest our way out of the problem. Everybody we caught, we arrested. We put them in jail, whatever we could do. And we couldn't put a dent in it. And then, all of a sudden, it shut down all by itself. It just closed down. Now, on that day was the same day that the states started a thing called the lottery.
Yeah.
And what we did to deal with that problem was we changed the name of the numbers racket to the lottery.
We got it
and
under control.
And we have legalized, regulated, and
controlled
numbers that we
yes.
deal with in this society. Now, that did not solve our gambling problem.
Right.
We still have people that are dumb enough to take their whole paycheck and blow it on the lottery tickets because they think they're going to win the big one.
Yes.
But it put a big dent in our crime problem.
Hmm.
And that's what we're talking about at LEAP. We're talking about the crime and violence that's associated with this underground marketplace. The drug problem is something we're going to have to deal with as long as there's human beings on this planet. We do not have to have gangsters and thugs and 13-year-old kids selling drugs on street corners. That's a choice that we've made to do that. We don't have to do that.
And it does seem like, really, it is a demand issue. And I think it's been pretty clear that throughout history, from alcohol, whatever, there is a demand for things that change your outlook, be it alcohol, whatever. It's always been there. And the question may be getting it under control. Bert Cohen here. You're listening to Portside. And we're talking with Peter Crist with LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition of Drugs. And one of the, we're talking about the war on drugs, and the question has been, will Obama end the war on drugs? And one of the things about the term war is that, oh no, it's not me, it's those others. It's
right.
those others. You make war on the other people. I have nothing to worry about. You know, forget that I get all these prescriptions and, you know, this tremendous prescription abuse. I would think, I don't really know, but my guess would be the abuse of prescription drugs is probably higher than any other drug problem. And yet, you know, the war on drugs, there's a war on cocaine and a lot of, I remember, oh, I don't know, 20 years or so ago when the crack boom came out, mm-hmm. then it was easy to make war on the other. It wasn't me using crack. There were prejudicial sentencing disparity between crack and powder cocaine. Let's face it, crack was used by inner city people, largely people of color, whereas powder cocaine was used by business people going to work every day, you know, nice, respectable, tie-wearing, you know, white people. And yet crack was punished much more. There was much more of a war on crack. Is this changing now? I mean, this discussion has been going on as long as there's been this war on drugs that, you know, it doesn't seem to be working. It's filling up our jails with people who still bring in drugs, as you say. But what do you know about this new appointment? Gil, and I may not pronounce it right, Kelikowski, Obama's
yep.
new head of drugs. What do you know about him? He was a police officer, was he not?
Yes, he was. His last position was chief of Seattle PD. And he replaced there a gentleman by the name of Norm Stamper, who was the chief before him of Seattle PD. And Norm Stamper is one of our leading speakers for LEAP.
Wow.
So the guy he replaced is a LEAP speaker.
No kidding.
Okay.
Huh.
And out there and calling for the legalization of drugs. Seattle had a pretty, under Stamper, it started and it continued under the new drug czar. They have made marijuana their lowest priority for police work. I mean, the last thing they did, they get a cat out of the tree before they make a marijuana arrest.
And they don't do cats out of trees very much.
Right, right. And they've started a needle exchange program in Seattle that has greatly reduced the HIV hepatitis transmission level because people sharing needles were passing disease back and forth with each other.
Mm.
So they're pretty, as far as the nation goes, the police department he comes from is very fairly forward-looking. He is not, the new drug czar is not a member of LEAP.
Right.
And I don't even want to insinuate that he is.
I wouldn't think so.
He is a drug warrior, or let me say, he is a good law enforcement officer who does the job that he is paid to do, and that's enforce these drug laws. But I think he has a little different view of it. He's used the term education and treatment as ways to deal with this problem. This is a hard change to make. We have had such a sell on this over the last 40 years, 30 years in this country, that it's very difficult to get people to change their mind, and particularly for politicians to stand up on this. Because I was up, in fact, it's ironic, and I'm not going to mention any names, but I was up in New Hampshire a couple of years ago, and I'm doing a Rotary presentation. I get done with the presentation, and one of the people that was there takes me off to the side and says to me, look, I'm an elected official here in New Hampshire. And he said, I agree with everything you said here today, but if I run on this issue,
right,
they could beat me with a dead one-legged dog. And that was his phrase. And I looked at him and I said, well, I'm sorry. And as soon as I said the word I'm sorry, I saw a defensive look in his posture, because I think what he thought I was going to say was that I'm sorry that you don't have the courage to stand up for... And I'm not that stupid.
Right.
What I said to him was, I'm sorry, I'm apologizing to you, because we in the drug reform movement haven't done our job well enough yet in order for you to run on this. We have to do more work to educate the public to the importance of this major change in our society. And I would much rather have somebody being elected office who agrees with us but doesn't say so, than somebody who is an adamant drug warrior on the other side and is going to pass even more laws and build more prisons and do all this other stuff. So I told him to keep doing what he's doing. We'll try to get it to the point where he can speak out publicly on this. But this is a big, you know, we have done in this society failed policy for decades before.
Yeah.
Let me give you an example. I'd like to thank all the women that are listening in today for representing a group of people who studied real hard, and finally, by 1920, women became intelligent enough to vote. I think they really deserve credit for studying like that. Now, I'm saying that with a big smile on my face, because we all know better than that. We all know that women were always intelligent enough to vote. The only problem was, for 150 years, we had a policy in effect that stopped women from voting. And that policy didn't become wrong in 1920. It was wrong in 1776 when it started.
Right.
And we never should have done that. Women should have, we never should have had slavery. Slavery is not just the moral aspect of slavery, but economically, slavery is a bad idea. Does it work? Do you have children?
Yes.
Now, I'm sure you love them dearly.
Yes.
Do you want them to live with you forever?
No.
Okay. Why? Because they're too damn expensive. All right?
And they'd like their freedom.
Exactly. Exactly. And you're going to have a problem with that if you try to do that. So you educate them. You give them the tools to go out. We all know that it's much easier to hire somebody for 8 hours a day, give them the money and let them go out and figure out where they're going to live and where they're going to eat, than it is to build a house for them and feed them and take care of them and all this other stuff. So slavery is stupid, not just on the moral level, but on the economic level. It doesn't work. But yet we did it as a nation for almost 100 years, and then we ended it, and we replaced it with another stupid policy called segregation.
Right.
And we did that for another 100 years
before
we started the... So we have done dumb things for a long time, and I'm not saying we, being just the U.S., every nation that's ever existed on this planet has done dumb things for a long time.
So how do we... But,
We learn and we move out of it.
Well, how do we learn? It does seem that, as with so many issues, the people are ahead of the politicians. It happens all the time. People ask, I understand this, I'm not positive that this is true, that when President Obama does his town hall meetings and just opens it up to questions, people ask about the drug war.
Exactly.
Over and over and over. And yet, I certainly don't know, and I know a lot of politicians, having been one myself, that nobody's going to take the lead on this. There's this, and what we've been talking about so far is the reasons why and proof of the drug policy, the drug war, being an absolute failure. It doesn't make war on other people. It makes war on people, on Americans.
Exactly.
And this new guy, Gil Kerlikowske, has said that, as he was quoted in the Wall Street Journal, regardless of how you try to explain to people it's a war on drugs or a war on product, people see war as war on them. We're
right.
not at war with the people in this country. Is that what is it going to happen? I mean, I am amazed, quite frankly, that we've been doing this same dumb thing over and over and over again. Here it is, 2009. Frankly, I would have thought it would have ended 30 years ago anyway,
yeah,
because it didn't work then. Is there, you're talking about rationality. There's proof, it doesn't work. And yet, there's something that is not rational that has been very effective, used by many different politicians, and that's fear.
Mm-hmm.
What can we do about the fear about it? You know, it's the war on those other people. And the politicians are afraid to talk about changing the policy. Although, in your state, New York, there's those infamous Rockefeller drug laws, which finally are changing. Is the fear starting? And people are afraid of drugs. They're afraid of the white powder of, you know, the unknown. And they are dangerous. I mean, they certainly can be dangerous. And it's something that we do need to get under control. What can we do about fear? You got any suggestions?
Well, yeah. Well, the thing is, one of the things that's helping us is the economy. And the reason I say that is, it isn't a coincidence that we ended alcohol prohibition in 1933, right at the beginning of the Great Depression. And the reason I say that is this: prohibition is a luxury item. When you have a lot of money in your pocket, you can spend your time and energy worrying about how your neighbors are cutting their lawn or what color they're painting their house or whatever, okay? When money gets tight, you really don't care too much what your neighbors are doing. All you're concerned about is whether you can keep food on your table and keep a roof over your head and that kind of thing. And it's, I think, the fact that we are in these bad economic times is going to force us to take a look at the $70 billion a year we're spending for this failed policy. So this might be one of those things that speeds up the process a little bit and gets people moving along and thinking. I mean, who would have thought, if I would have told you that in a couple of years ago, if I would have told you that in a few years, Arnold Schwarzenegger
right.
is going to be on television calling for not medical marijuana, but the legalization of recreational use of marijuana as an economic thing to help the economy of California, you would have told me I was out of my mind.
True.
No politician would ever do that.
Well,
here we are.
Yes.
And that's exactly what he's done. So it's these economic times, it's that old yin-yang thing. You should live during interesting times because interesting times are always good and they're always bad.
they are interesting.
And so this is one of the things that may help, but also just the fact that we have a much easier way today to communicate with each other. We actually live during a time today where if you don't know something, it's your fault.
Mm.
You know, it used to be that the information wasn't available, but today with the internet and everything else, the information is available. So there's more people that are getting the word on this. There's things like our website and other websites of organizations that are involved in this stuff that are bringing more and more discussion to it. So I'm hopeful. I'm not I'm not delusional.
You're not Pollyanna.
I'm 62 years old,
uh-huh.
and I would very much like to see this drug war over with tomorrow.
Right.
But I also know that there's a possibility that I may not live to see the end of it. But that doesn't mean it's not going to end. That only means I'm old.
Well, as Martin Luther King famously said, I've seen, you know, the vision. I may not get there with you.
Right.
But it is happening. And I do wonder about how much of a change we can really expect under President Obama and the new drug czar, Gil Kerlikowske. You know, they talk about it. He's been talking the talk. But, you know, there's always talk and then there's action, walking the walk. And the action is on the budget. The 09 and 10 budget process, as I understand it, I haven't looked at it that thoroughly, but it seems to continue, for example, the ban on federal funding of needle exchange programs.
Right.
And there's a question of, will this be a kinder, gentler drug war, or is it a real change? What do you think we can expect from the top? I mean, there's still the state legislators that can do something, as you say, in California, where they're frankly so desperate for money that they realize, hey, hello, there's a lot of money in the marijuana trade. Maybe we can tax the heck out of that and help reduce the humongous budget deficit there. But how much change do you think we can expect? Will it be a real end to the drug war? Will we see, I've actually heard that the Obama budget allocates more to drug enforcement and less to prevention than even George Bush did. What do you know about that?
That would not surprise me, and because we're caught in this trap. You know, it's interesting, and it's hard to guess, to give an answer to that, because if this was 1988 and you were asking me how long did I think the Soviet Union was going to last, I would have told you that they're probably going to be around for another 100 years.
Sure.
And then in 89, all of a sudden,
kaboom,
all that changed.
Yeah.
You know, and it's, and this is the same kind of thing. It's that kind of thing that, well, this is what we have to do, this is what we have to do, and then all of a sudden there's a sea change, and people see it different. If it ends tomorrow, it's not too soon. You have to understand that roughly half of our prison cells in America, prison and jail cells in America, are filled by nonviolent drug offenders. And these cells are costing us $25,000 to $30,000 a head to keep people in these cells. Now, and again, as I said before, and no drug-free prisons.
Okay. Yeah, right.
So the economics of it might pool this thing. We may come through this economic thing and fall into another slump. We might get some other, you know, big drug warrior out there that's going to come up with some new idea that's not going to work, but he's going to be able to sell it properly and get people refueled behind this thing. I'm not sure. The only thing I know is that we're a pretty intelligent species. And even though we do dumb things, we usually don't do them forever. You know, at some point we get the right idea. I mean, there's still an organization over in England called the Flat Earth Society. But they don't have a real big membership.
Yeah.
You know,
so
it's now, it used to be that 90% of the people thought the earth was flat.
Right.
And it's and they were 100% sure that they were right, you know, and that they had the right to punish other people for not thinking that way.
But meantime,
you know, so we've gone through this before. We will get through this again. It's going to take time. But I'll tell you, the thing that's going to make it last the longest is if we have silence about it. So the more we talk about it, the more opportunities people have to hear about a different message. When I do presentations, I get two comments. I call them the silver and the gold comment, and I get them at every presentation. And the silver comment is the people that come up to me and say, boy, I'm so glad you were here today. I've been thinking this way for years. It's about time somebody's here talking about it. That's the silver comment.
Okay.
The gold comment is when people come up to me and say, I never looked at it this way before. Because that's where change starts, is when people see something new for the first time. And that's what we're trying to bring about at LEAP, and there's other organizations that are also trying to do the same thing. and to educate the public that this is a failed policy.
We are talking on Portside with Peter Crist, who was an officer in the drug war for 20 years now with Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. You know, I still come back to fear. Politicians never, ever, ever want to look soft on crime, you know, and people are concerned about drugs. We, you know, as parents, we're worried about our kids taking drugs. Do you see politicians still being so scared to look soft on crime? And as you say, there's just such a lack of leadership, such a lack of backbone in politicians now when it comes to drugs. How can, you know, what can we do? What would work to get our politicians to be able to do something about their fear and to actually do something to show that something else does work? I guess basically, what can work? What can we talk about that will make it tougher for kids to get drugs? And to, you know, how can we actually have a program? What program, what argument, what option can we give politicians to say, okay, the war on drugs doesn't work. You and I want to keep our kids off drugs. What can work? What is LEAP suggesting?
Well, we could look, there is a lot of different ways to regulate and control drugs. We could take all these illegal drugs and make them only available by prescription. Now, if we did that, it would still create an underground marketplace like there is for prescription drugs. But we have two types of underground marketplace. One is called the black market, and that's the distribution of illegal things in an illegal marketplace.
Right.
The other is called the gray market. That's where Rush Limbaugh got his OxyContin from.
Uh-huh.
That's the distribution of legal things that have been diverted to an illegal marketplace.
Right.
Now, gray markets, we know a few things about them. One is they're less violent than black markets are, generally.
Right.
And secondly, they also have what we call, in law enforcement, a break point. If all of a sudden we start seeing drugs, you know, OxyContin on the streets of our community, we start looking at the last burglary of a drugstore. We have some place to start our investigation from, because at some point, these things were legal, and now
right.
somebody is stolen them or diverted them
sure.
in some way into an illegal marketplace.
Right.
So it's easier to investigate. So you have less violence, and you have investigations that are easier than a black market investigation. Another thing we could look at is another way we could do it would be to distribute it like we distribute alcohol or tobacco. Now, it's interesting. I was up in Schenectady. I did a presentation at a high school, and I was on a panel with another LEAP member, and there was a couple local law enforcement, a judge, and somebody from the DA's office that were opposite us on the panel. And we opened it up for question and answers, and as the beginning of the questioning, a student stood up, a young man, and he said, if I want to get tobacco or alcohol, I have to find an adult who is willing to risk being arrested to get me alcohol or tobacco. And then he pulled out his cell phone, he held it up in the air, and he said, but if I want any illegal drug, all I have to do is call a number on this phone, and I can walk out in front of the school in 30 minutes and have it delivered to me.
Right, because
now,
it's the black market.
That's what we have to stop. In fact, it's interesting because a lot of times when you talk about this, people will say, well, I understand the marijuana issue, but you're not talking about legalizing crack cocaine or methamphetamine or any of those drugs. And my answer is summed up by one of our members whose name is Jerry Cameron, who's a retired chief of police from down in Florida, and he's a LEAP speaker. And he says, when hit with that question, it's real simple. Whatever drug you want 13-year-old children to sell in the street corners of your community, you keep that drug illegal, and that's who will be selling it.
Oh, geez.
I don't want 13-year-old children to be selling any drugs in my community. Therefore, I know I have to legalize, regulate, and control all of them.
So how do you get it under control? What would a sensible policy look like to keep those 13-year-olds from getting that, you know, stuff?
Well, we have to have it only available through licensed distributors who get their license because they follow the rules. And we have to have it out there in the open. We at least have to know that the drugs that the that the, if they are getting them, we at least have to know that they're pharmaceutically pure and that they're not buying stuff that's mixed with that poison, because that's the cheapest thing for the gangster to do out there on the street. So we can at least eliminate those problems. We can take the thugs out of the business. We can take the profit out of it, so kids, their only involvement with drugs is being the use of drugs, not that they're involved with drugs because they can make all this money at it. Why do we have that extra lure in there for our youth to be involved in this thing? We can take that out of it.
But and we don't want it to just have drugs in the open, you know, free market, just, you know, everywhere.
Like we do now.
Right. So that's a good point. What? So you talk about registration, you know.
Yeah, you would, and there's many different ways. You know, what's interesting, when we ended alcohol prohibition, we did not set up a federal alcohol regulation program. We just got the federal government out of the prohibition problem, and then we let the states figure out how they were going to do it. Some states stayed dry for a while. Some states set a drinking age of 18. Some states said package stores. Some states said we're going to sell it in grocery stores. We had this whole patchwork quilt across this country that didn't start changing until the drug war kicked off and then assumed the right to also start interfering with our alcohol policies. That was the point. When I was a kid growing up, the drinking age of New York State was 18.
Yeah, I remember.
And then it changed to 21.
Yes.
And we saw an increase in the number of deaths due to alcohol poisoning after that increase happened. Because now, when I was 16, 17, 18 years old, I was drinking in taverns where there were people around who were adults and kind of monitored my behavior and told me what was acceptable behavior and what wasn't. Well, we raised the drinking age to 21. We changed that environment. Now, we didn't stop kids from drinking, but what we did was stop them from being around adults when they drank. And they started drinking out behind the barn with, you know, a bunch of other kids the same age. None of them had any solid experience with this drug, and some of them died, okay, and are continuing to die.
Right.
So we have to understand, when I do presentations, particularly a group like Rotary, they do foreign exchange student work.
Sure.
And if they have a foreign exchange student at their Rotary meeting that's from a Western European country, France, Portugal, Spain, Italy, whatever,
yep.
I ask those, and I've done this 7 times, and 5 times I've gotten the same answer, 2 times a different answer. I ask them, when you first came to America, what struck you as the oddest thing about your peer group? You know, those other high school seniors that they were going to be living with for a year.
Uh-huh.
What was the strangest thing about them?
Uh-huh.
And 5 out of 7 times I've heard the way they drink. Not that they drink.
Right.
But the idea of going out on Friday night, not just to party and have a good time, but
right.
to get blitzed,
yes.
to get hammered.
That
is an American youth problem. That is not a European youth problem. Because some of those countries I mentioned don't even have a drinking age.
Right.
You know, they've been teaching children about the use of this very, because they know it's prevalent, they know it's around, so they figure, well, if we're going to have children around, we better teach them as soon as possible the safest way to do this. It's kind of like if we use the same standard for teaching people how to drive automobiles as we do for drinking, what we would do is tell you that you cannot be in a car, around a car, anywhere near a car until you're 21 years old. And then when you're 21 years old, here's the keys to the fastest car in the world. Go be safe. Okay, well, that would be stupid. We
yes.
would have death all over the place.
Yes.
We have to start with these kids at 16 and teach them how to drive. And even then we have problems, but we're minimizing the problems because we're using education and we're dealing with it. And then we look at alcohol, and that's the method we use. Don't do it, don't do it, don't do it. You can do it now as much as you want.
And I think
it makes no sense to me.
You keep talking about educating. It's got to be the most important thing to fight the fear, to fight the rationality, to take on the lure of the forbidden fruit. And I, you know, the Republicans a long time ago, I happen to be a Democrat, always were talking about personal responsibility. Take right. personal responsibility. And what you're talking about is, you know, once you reach this age, hey, go crazy. Do whatever you want, you know?
Yep.
Personal responsibility.
And you have to learn that. I mean, my parents taught it to me almost from the cradle that, you know, when you're an adult, you have to be responsible for your actions and so on and so forth. I had that drummed into me. That was the most important thing that my parents thought I should know, is that I had to be responsible for my actions. What? And we tend in this, in fact, there's a term that used to follow this kind of discussion, and the term used to be victimless crime.
Right.
Well, you can't even use that term in America anymore, because everybody is a victim of something. Nobody's responsible anymore for what they do. These instead of victimless crime, I prefer the term consensual crime. And these are consenting adults that are doing this, using these drugs.
Right.
And they are not going to be dissuaded. In fact, I've had people say to me, I can't understand why people get into this drug business. Don't they know that they could lose their liberty or they could die? You know, they could be killed. Why would they do this? And my answer to that is, you know, we have people that I and we, rightfully, men and women, that we call heroes that are over in Iraq and Afghanistan right now, that are risking their life and liberty every day for us for a heck of a lot less money than these drug dealers are making.
Right.
Now, nobody calls them crazy. You know,
people,
we honor them as they should be. Now, I'm not saying we should honor the drug dealers,
no.
But don't think that going after the money is somehow insane. You know, I
it
mean,
seems
we
to
all
me,
do that.
It seems to me that going after the money is like what this country is all about.
Exactly.
We've come up to the end of the hour. Peter Chris, thank you so much. How can people find out more? And I'm sure people will want to find out more. Tell us which website is best to go to people can find
out.
Well,
they can go to leap.cc, and if that's too difficult, they can just type the word LEAP, L-E-A-P, into Google,
right.
And our website is the first thing that comes up.
Educate
so that's
yourself.
That's one of the easy ways to get to us, or leap.cc. And from there, there's other websites you can connect to. You can look around and see what we're doing. If you'd like to have one of us come out and speak to your group or whatever, you can contact us at that website, and we can provide speakers. We have speakers at no charge that are able to come out and speak. We have speakers all over the country, so usually we get somebody in if somebody requests one. And that's the way we're going to change this.
Righto.
Is to force the discussion.
Force the discussion. Educate people. Peter Christ of LEAP,
yep.
Thanks so much for being with us on Portside.
Thank you.
Bert Cohen here. Thanks for listening to Portside.
It ain't nothing but a heartbreaker. I got one friend. Can't get